From BDWPS.com and BDWPS Podcasts, this is Year of the Bowie, a podcast series that tells the story of David Bowie. I'm your host, Andy. If you haven't listened to the first 8 episodes yet, I would recommend giving them a listen before proceeding with today's show. If you like what you hear on this month's episode, I would love if you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. Just search Year of the Bowie. And now, for the final episode of Year of the Bowie. David Bowie was behind the times in 1988. While he had been capitalizing off his mainstream success, a new generation of cutting-edge musicians were beginning to fester in the underground. A year after the release of Bowie's unfulfilling, unimaginative effort, Never Let Me Down, artists like Sonic Youth, The Pixies, and My Bloody Valentine were making waves with unconventional albums that challenged listeners in the same way Bowie had done a decade earlier. Ready to reconnect with his creative muse, Bowie decided to try a completely new approach to his music. The inspiration for the new project would come as a result of a chance encounter with guitarist Reeves Gabrels.
In 1987, I met Bowie and through my ex-wife, and because she did press for him on one tour, and I met him. Never told him I played guitar. At the end of the tour, he found out. She gave him a copy of a band I had, and about 6 months later, he called me up and he said, "Why didn't you tell me?" And then next thing, I ended up playing with him, and from there, David asking me to write with him in 88, and then that became Tin Machine. But that just kind of, once I had the Bowie Good Housekeeping seal of approval, it opened up, basically right, yeah. Everything else.
Tin Machine would be Bowie's first effort as a member of a band rather than a solo artist. The band would aim for an edgier, more indie rock sound in the same vein as the artists mentioned a moment ago. Here's Bowie discussing Tin Machine's approach to music.
It was a question of finding the right kind of music that really didn't have too much orchestration about it. And the easiest kind of music to become free on, because it only has 2 or 3 chords in, is rock and roll. Otherwise, if it started getting too chordy and arranged, it wouldn't be anything like what we wanted to do, because we wanted to put our own individual personalities into what we were playing, and it was very important. It was the structure was as loose as possible so that everybody could improvise to a certain extent on what we were doing. And rock and roll is the best format, and it's the music we all love.
Released in 1989, the self-titled album would be embraced by modern and hard rock radio stations, although many of the fans the band was aiming for didn't take the bait. Thurston Moore of the band Sonic Youth said of the band, "When I first saw Tin Machine, I thought, underground music is sort of primal and raw and new. Tin Machine couldn't reference this kind of music because they're too good as players. It was okay to a degree, but it was put on the air that it was indie rock, and it was hardly that." Bowie would defend Tin Machine in 2003, saying, "It accomplished what it was supposed to do, which was to bring me back to my absolute roots and set me back on the right course of what I do best." Instead of playing stadiums in support of the album, Tin Machine played small theaters and large clubs, resulting in Bowie's first intimate performances since the early 70s. Later that year, record label Rykodisc offered to release remastered versions of Bowie's RCA albums, to which he agreed. To support the re-release, he would end his Tin Machine tour in order to embark on the worldwide Sound and Vision tour. After reconnecting with the smaller audiences, the massive world tour would be disappointing for David.
It started, and wouldn't say that you tour for fun. I think I got over that probably about 1973, 1974. I think fun doesn't come into touring at all for me. I think it's hideously boring. I think the playing makes it worthwhile.
Once done with the tour, Bowie returned to the studio to work on Tin Machine 2. The second Tin Machine album would be poorly received by critics and would also be the band's last effort together. Perhaps the creative drop-off was in direct correlation with a new love in David's life at that time. At the urging of a close friend and hairdresser, David met supermodel Iman on a blind date. On that first night, the same man who once said he could never love again after having his heart broken by Hermione in 1969 was beginning to see the light again. Here's Iman discussing their first meeting.
He claims that he knew immediately I was the one. It took me maybe a week.
6 months after meeting, David proposed to Iman over a candlelight dinner in Paris.
David courted me a very old-fashioned way, which was such a delight. People don't expect things like that from him. You know, they think he's so hip and happening, and you know, but he's truly an old-fashioned gentleman.
The wedding would be held in June of 1992. The press had been informed it would be on the island of Mustique, but this was just a diversion. The wedding in Florence would be attended by 70 people, and David's son Duncan, now 20, who would serve as the best man. Eric Idle of Monty Python fame would be in attendance, and had this observation of the attendees.
At his wedding, there was Brian Eno, Bono and Yoko Ono. And I thought, there's a gag waiting to happen, Eno, Ono and Bono. How often, you know, do you get all three of those at one wedding?
Unlike his tumultuous marriage to Angie, the loving bond between David and Iman would be a lasting, fulfilling one.
David swept me off my feet, and I'm still off my feet. he has managed somehow, I don't know, miraculously, to have my heart flutter when he walks into the room still. So, yes, he's definitely the one. He's definitely my one.
Inspired by his newfound love, Bowie returned to the studio to record Black Tie, White Noise, his first solo album in 5 years. He brought Nile Rodgers back in to produce the album and also reunited with guitarist Mick Ronson for the first time in 20 years. The decision to reconnect with Ronson could have been due in part to the fact that his old friend had been diagnosed with terminal liver cancer and only had a few months left to live. He died just days after the album would be released. Bowie would announce his passing while appearing on Arsenio Hall.
One quick thing, because you're talking about bands and playing with people. Would you like to seriously speak on Mick just for a second?
Yeah, the band, the Spiders from Mars. That was the whole situation that sort of got me the kind of fame that I had in the early 70s. And the lead guitarist with that band was Mick Ronson, and unfortunately, yeah. And Mick, tragically, he succumbed to cancer 3 or 4 days ago. And in his passing, I want to say that of all the early 70s guitar players, Mick was probably one of the most influential and profound, and I miss him a lot.
The label had hoped that Black Tie, White Noise would be Bowie's big comeback album. But it was upstaged by his ex-wife Angie's tell-all book, Backstage Passes, and her controversial admission on the Joan Rivers and Howard Stern show.
So you caught him in bed with a guy?
I caught him in bed with men several times. In fact, one of the best times I caught him in bed was with Mick Jagger.
You did
catch him? I came back from a trip.
David Bowie would deny the rumors, and years later, Angie would admit that she'd only caught the two rock stars sleeping next to each other, not engaging in any sexual activity. Sales of Black Tie, White Noise were also hurt by Rodgers' crisp, clean production that stood in stark contrast to the sound of the grunge movement. Bowie may not have been able to relate to the young, rebellious grunge fans, But artists from the genre began name-checking Bowie as an influence to their experimental approach. In 1994, Kurt Cobain would perform The Man Who Sold the World on MTV Unplugged, and in 1991, Dinosaur Jr. would cover Bowie's Quicksand on their album Whatever's Cool With Me.
I'm closer to the golden dawn. I can't believe the wagon's gone. It's history. I'm living in a callous realm where others seem to dig it just too much reality. I'm frightened by the total goal. I'm drawing to the ragged hole, and I ain't got the wagon anymore. No, I ain't got the wagon anymore.
For the second decade in a row, Bowie was inspiring a generation of outsider musicians. But this time, he embraced the love, instead of resenting it like he had in the 80s.
That we've become part of the complex fabric of influences that are the part of the new scene of contemporary bands. And it's just great to like see covers made of my songs from like Dinosaur Jr. through bands like Smashing Pumpkins. I mean, that kind of thing is really rewarding. And that's not been in evidence until the last 4 or 5 years. And it's great. It makes me competitive again. I'm very competitive.
After the failure of the straightforward effort Black Tie White Noise, Bowie drew inspiration from Trent Reznor and his work with the industrial band Nine Inch Nails.
Funnily enough, yeah, I'd heard a Pretty Hate Machine, but and it was just a passing interest. I'll be brutally frank.
You just said
you be honest.
Another snappy tune.
No, not snappy tune so much as that it was an interesting album, but it was. I think it was inadvertently it was MTV's fault because I saw the video that you'd banned and I thought that's really good, that's a great video. And what happened is that because of that I then really got into what he was doing, and then Downward Spiral was really, I thought, just an exceptional album, really excellent.
To help guide his journey back into the world of electronic music, Bowie reconnected with synth du jour Brian Eno, who had built a prestigious reputation as a producer since working with David 15 years earlier.
He's very good at what-ifing you were to do this, or what if you were to do that, and possibly come up with a new choices of avenues to take that maybe we wouldn't otherwise have thought of.
The album, entitled Outside, would be Bowie's most experimental conceptual album since Logic. Borrowing heavily from the world of industrial music, Outside told the story of a detective trying to find answers in a millennial world where a phenomenon known as art murder has gained popularity. Bowie also wanted to go outside of his comfort zone for the tour, so he contacted Trent Reznor in hopes of opening for Nine Inch Nails in the fall of 1995. Here's what Reznor said about that memorable phone call from his hero.
Yeah, it was scary at first, but then, I mean, hi, it's David Bowie. And at first I didn't think it was, but then instantly you knew that it was. I wasn't even thinking at that point. I was just, it's a weird feeling. It was a bit freaked out, but such a charming gentleman that I was instantly at ease. And he mentioned his idea of doing this tour and got me thinking about it, and then I realized that it would be something that I'd be it'd be a challenge to do, and I think then it would be a challenge to present the whole show in a unique way. So it's not just the opening act, headline act, but it's something that was a bit unusual that would make it make sense in a way.
While on tour, Bowie began to see a bit of himself in Reznor, who was struggling with drug and alcohol addiction, all while dealing with a rise in fame.
He's a very shy guy, and I recognize in him aspects of himself 20, 30 years ago, you know. I do see that same kind of, he has an awful lot he wants to say, and the only way that he can really articulate it is through the songs. And I kind of recognize that. So I think we both have that very kind of isolated kind of standing.
In a recent interview, Reznor said, "I remember a couple of nights of him putting his arm around me like I was his brother, giving me advice. He'd been there himself, and I knew he'd been through a lot of bad shit. It made me feel like, all right, someone can come out the other end and still be cool." The tour was a different experience for Bowie. Nine Inch Nails fans were disrespectful, but they also didn't know what to make of Bowie's set, which was comprised almost solely of his newer avant-garde material. Bowie enjoyed the challenge of taking the stage to an audience unfamiliar with his work.
The one thing I can say for Trent's audience is that I think so far they're very intelligent. I mean, it's very tough for Nails fans in that way, because it's 1.5 hours of music that not even my audience would know. It's totally unknown to them. An hour and a half of songs they've never heard before in their lives, and they're so attentive and willing to listen. It's just incredible, you know?
While on tour, Bowie found himself listening to the trip-hop drum and bass sounds of British acts like Massive Attack, Tricky, Portishead, Underworld, and Prodigy. Inspired by the new sounds coming from his homeland, Bowie began recording his next album, Earthling, in Manhattan in 1996. For the album, he brought in digital recording maestro Mark Platy. He also received an assist from his new friend, Trent Reznor, who offered up a remix of the song, I'm Afraid of Americans. The new version would give Bowie his first radio hit of the 90s.
Jonas in America, no tricks at the wheel. No one needs anyone, they don't even just pretend. Jonas in America.
I'm afraid of America. The world, I'm afraid I can't help it. I'm afraid I can't. I'm afraid of Americans. I'm afraid of the world. I'm afraid I can't help it. I'm afraid I can't. I'm afraid of Americans.
Shortly after his 50th birthday in January of 1997, Bowie went on a tour of large theaters in hopes of connecting more with his audience than a stadium could provide. The waning interest in drum and bass music may have also had an impact on the change to a smaller venue. Earthlings as an album didn't have much impact on the charts, but Bowie's use of technology to support his album and tour would be revolutionary. Bowie would be the first artist ever to release a song online when he put a digitally downloadable track entitled Telling Lies on his website, bowie.net, for free.
But I've always figured that I probably share one thing in common with Prince, is that we both overwrite. We both have an incredible backlog of material. And it occurs to me that a good way of making the maybe more esoteric or avant-garde or whatever you want to call it, or weird stuff that maybe Nancy wouldn't want on her label because it's not something she can really deal with in that way, available to people, is to put it onto the net so they can download it if they want it. And there won't be that many people that would want it, because some of it is pretty weird. But it's a great way of making stuff available. So I don't feel this stuff is all like building up behind me and I've got no place to put it.
Despite being a man in his 50s, Bowie embraced the internet, creating a message board community on his website where fans could interact with him. For example, after shows on the Earthling tour, he would go online and interact with the fans, getting reactions and feedback. Basically, Bowie understood the power of social media a decade before Facebook and Twitter would even be created.
We've always used the net to get immediate feedback on what we're doing whilst we're on tour. If we put a new song in the show, after the show, within half an hour sometimes, we get immediate feedback on if the song was any good or if it was crap. So it's pretty fantastic in just immediate feedback. And if you go into conversation mode, it's quite interesting to plant misinformation and false rumors and let people deal with it.
What were some of the questions they were asking? Do you recall any of them that stood out in your mind?
Why did you kill Ziggy?
Nancy Miller, editor of Wired magazine, said of Bowie's influence on social media, quote, "The idea of fans communicating directly with their favorite artist was nurtured by David Bowie. His website was a proto-MySpace, and I don't think I'm overstating it to say that." In 2007, he would be granted a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Webby Awards due to his innovations. His pioneering use of the internet would continue with his 1999 album, Hours. Leading up to the release of the album, Bowie launched a contest on his message board that offered fans a chance to write the lyrics to his song, What's Really Happening. A student from Ohio won the contest and was flown to New York City to see the song recorded. In another step in innovation, the entire recording was simulcast on Bowie.net. Despite his efforts to draw attention to Hours, it would be his first album to fail to crack the American Top 40 in over a quarter century. But Bowie had little time to wallow in the album's failure with the birth of his and Iman's daughter, Alexandria Zara, on August 15, 2000. Over the next 16 years, his daughter would become the center of his universe. Here's Iman and friend Robin Clark discussing how he became a changed man.
She's totally spoiled by him. You know, of course, he was over the moon that her first words was Dada, and I kept on telling him, no, that's the easy word. No, he's not buying it.
At one point, I asked him, I said, how are you, you know, how's it going? And he says, oh, I'm a stay-at-home dad, you know.
The birth of his daughter also inspired David to reconnect with friends from the past. For his 2003 album, he worked with Tony Visconti for the first time since 1980. The two hadn't been on talking terms since Visconti refused to mix the sound for his Serious Moonlight tour. But a late-night coffee date would resolve these issues.
It does seem that when we work together, there seems to be a kind of a chemistry between us that I don't find with virtually no other producers. I've never really been able to identify what it is, but it has something to do with a lack of judgment on his part. He sort of allows me to go with my head about what I want to do, and he never sort of tells me this can't be done or that can't be done, you know? So it's, I feel that I have a lot of liberty with him, which is good.
The duo, who were both living in Manhattan at the time, chose to take the recording process to Allaire Studios in the Catskill Mountains in upstate New York. The two would be working on the album the morning of September 11th, 2001, when the first plane flew into the North Tower of the World Trade Center. The event would inspire the somber album opener, Sunday.
Nothing remains. We could run when the rain snows. Look for the cause or signs of life where the heat goes.
Released the following June, Heathen would be an across-the-board success, Bowie's biggest critical and commercial hit since the early 80s. Pitchfork.com would write of the album, quote, "Where 2000's Hours was a brooding, wrist-slitting account of Bowie's laments about growing old, Heathen is the sound of acceptance. He's relaxed, even serene, and the songs clearly reflect this. As they say, the birth of a child can change a man." A month after the release of Heathen, Bowie agreed to perform at a 9/11 tribute concert. David would open the entire show with a haunting performance of Simon and Garfunkel's America.
Let us be lovers, we'll marry our fortunes together. I've got some real estate here in my bag. So we bought a pack of cigarettes, Mrs. Wagner's pies, and walked off to look for America.
Shortly after helping a city deal with its grief, Bowie had to deal with his own personal loss in the death of his mother at the age of 88. Iman's mother would die 2 months later, and the couple would find solace in each other. Hot off the heels of Heathen's success, Bowie and Visconti returned to the studio to record the follow-up album, Reality. The album would come out in September of 2003 and be greeted with strong reviews and sales. Over the course of the ensuing tour, Bowie suffered several physical ailments, including laryngitis, the flu, and he even took a lollipop to the eye that had been thrown from the audience. But none of that compared to what happened on June 25th, 2004, when Bowie collapsed on stage.
Sisters revealed he had angioplasty surgery for a blocked artery at a German hospital last month. At the time, fans were told Bowie had cut short his European tour because of a pinched nerve. The 57-year-old, who's had various nicknames like Ziggy Stardust and the Thin White Duke, is now recovering at home with his family.
Publicist Mitch Snyder ensured that it was just a routine surgery, but an unnamed Bowie friend told tabloids that, quote, "it was a lot more serious than anyone's letting on." Based on Bowie's output over the next 10 years, one can come to the conclusion that it had indeed been a serious health scare. Bowie would go into hiding for the next decade, not releasing any music and rarely making televised appearances. He'd occasionally be spotted around New York City getting coffee or at the park with his daughter, but his public persona was no more. This absence made his brief reemergences all the more special. In 2005, he joined the up-and-coming indie band Arcade Fire on stage at the Fashion Awards. His guest appearance in 2006 on Ricky Gervais's show Extras is arguably the show's finest moment.
I think I've sold out, to be honest, but yeah, it's difficult, isn't it, to keep your integrity when you're going for that first...
Little fat man who sold his soul.
The little...
Little fat man who sold his dream. Chubby little loser. Chubby little loser, national joke. No, not chubby little loser.
No.
pathetic little fat man. No one's bloody laughing. The clown that no one laughs at. They all just wish he'd die. He's so depressed at being useless. The fat man takes his own life.
No, no.
He's so depressed at being hated. Fatty takes his own life.
Fatty, Fatso.
Fatty. Fatso, I like that.
Yeah, let's go with Fatso.
Fatso takes his own life. He blows his bloated face off.
No.
He blows his stupid brains out.
But the twat I'd probably miss.
Yes, Linda, I like that.
Yeah, so do I. It's brilliant, Linda.
He sold his soul for a shard of fame. Catchphrase and wig and the jokes are lame. He's got no style. He's got no grace. He's banal and facile. He's a fat waste of space.
Yeah, yeah. Everybody sing that last line. One, two, three.
He's banal and facile. He's a fat waste of space. See his puck, no space. Puck, 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 puck. Again. See his puck, no space. Yeah. Puck, puck, puck.
In 2007, Bowie's voice acting on SpongeBob SquarePants as Lore Royal Highness of Atlantis drew a record 9 million viewers, rivaling The Sopranos finale for the most-watched cable show that year.
Welcome to Atlantis. I've been expecting you. I am the Lord Royal Highness, but my friends call me LRH.
My friends call me SpongeBob.
Pleasure to meet you. Come, I'll give you the grand tour of our Atlantean fortress.
And in 2009, he flew to Park City, Utah to see his son's directorial debut at the Sundance Festival. Here's Duncan discussing how nervous he was about his father seeing his film.
Has your father seen the film?
He has, actually. He came to Sundance. That's when we showed it the first time. Uh-huh. And that was very nerve-wracking because no one had seen it at that point.
And he hadn't seen any of the process up to it?
A very, very early rough cut. But he said that he didn't want to see anything more until the film was finished. So Sundance was the big reveal. And that was just nerve-wracking. But he loved it. And then we showed it again at Tribeca recently. And at that point, everyone had seen it. And he knew he liked it. And that was much more relaxed. Much more enjoyable.
The film, entitled Moon, would go on to win Outstanding Debut at the BAFTA Awards, and afterwards, Duncan would credit his love of science fiction to his dad, who had showed him Stanley Kubrick films when he was just a little kid. By the time 2013 rolled around, everyone assumed that David Bowie had retired from music. But on January 8th, which also happened to be David's 67th birthday, it was announced that his first album in a decade would be coming out, entitled The Next Day. The album would be recorded at the Magic Shop Studio in New York City alongside Tony Visconti over a two-year period. Bowie wanted the project to be kept a secret and even required anyone involved with the project to sign non-disclosure agreements. Upon release, the album would receive critical acclaim.
It's the darkest hour, you're 22.
Despite the positive reception and sales, Bowie insisted that there would be no live performances in support of the album. Instead, he returned to the studio to begin work on his next album. Just like The Next Day, this album would be done in secret. Here's Visconti discussing the top secret sessions.
Another remarkable album and a remarkable experience being in the studio with my old buddy. And this time we just scrambled the eggs a different way. We took a jazz band, the Donnie McCaslin Band, who are incredible. Jason Linden on keyboard, Mark Juliana on drums, who really changed our lives. And Timothy Lefevre, who is a bass player. I think he's based in LA, but he came specifically to join us. You know, it's not a jazz album. It's jazz musicians playing rock.
At the center of it all.
When I met David Bowie, he was 19 years old and I was 22. David was always experimental, And till this day, he still is. He likes to take time in the studio and go to places that we didn't plan on going. But he likes to have the studio as an open kind of playground.
Once again, Bowie would shock and excite fans with the surprise release of the song Lazarus in December of 2015. The 25th album in his rich catalog, entitled Black Star, would be released January 8, 2016, the day of Bowie's 69th birthday. 2 days later, another Bowie secret would be revealed to the world.
Some breaking news in to us just now this morning. It's been confirmed that David Bowie, singer and musician, has died at the age of 69 this morning.
Yes, that news just in the last couple of moments or so. A report saying that he had been suffering from cancer, had a profound influence, didn't he, on music and fashion, and also, as well, a really successful acting career as well.
David had been suffering with terminal liver cancer for 18 months, but he kept his illness a secret to almost everyone, even the musicians recording Black Star with him. Some of his closest friends were kept in the dark, even Brian Eno. Eno said, quote, "His death came as a complete surprise, as did nearly everything else about him. I feel a huge gap now." He would go on to tell a story of the last email exchange with his longtime friend. He said, quote, "I received an email from him 7 days ago. It was funny as always, and as surreal, looping through word games and allusions and all the usual stuff we did. It ended with this sentence, 'Thank you for our good times, Brian. They will never rot.' And he signed it, Dawn. I realize now he was saying goodbye."
Look up here. I'm in heaven. I've got scars that can't be seen. I've got drama can't be stolen. Everybody knows me now.
David also left a coded message to his fans in the form of Black Star, an album laced with biblical allusions, macabre imagery, and cryptic metaphors. Visconti said of the powerful album, quote, "His death was not different from his life, a work of art. He made Black Star for us, his parting gift." The album was uniformly praised by critics and would be featured in the top 10 best album list for the most prominent music publications there are. It would be number one on a few of them. There would be no funeral. Instead, David's body was cremated and buried in a secret grave. However, memorials have sprouted up all around the world. At his mural in his hometown of Brixton, outside his home in New York and Berlin, and at his Hollywood Star in Los Angeles. David would leave half of his $100 million estate to Iman, who would put much of it towards charitable contributions in 2016. 2 months ago, Iman won the Voice Award at the Save the Children's annual gala. She used the moment to pay tribute to her late husband.
"My husband, David, was also a staunch supporter of human rights and devoted an innumerable amount of time and resources, which he chose to do it unanimously. I share this award with him, knowing that the fire in him lit the fire in me, and vice versa. Good partnerships have a habit of doing that. So while this work is never done, I'm grateful and humbled by this recognition. And thank you for many times over. Thank you."
It's an understatement to say that Bowie's legacy will live on. Beside the unfinished projects, including a Lazarus musical, his impact on the world is undeniable. From his gender-bending ways, to his outlandish style, to his boundary-pushing music, to his influence on artists over the years and for decades to come. I went into this podcast being a big fan of David Bowie, but I've somehow come out the other end an even more devoted fan to his work and his legend. I hope you've enjoyed taking the journey with me over the past year. If you'd like to continue keeping in touch, I have a blog over at bdwps.com where I write about new music, and I also have another podcast, BDWPS Podcast. I didn't know what I was getting into when I started this project back in April, but I'm really proud of how it turned out. I've contemplated continuing with the series next year, possibly exploring another artist, but I might need a few months break before I get back into it. If anything, let Bowie's story be one of inspiration. Go out, create, express yourself. And as Bowie said it best, we can be heroes just for one day. Thanks for listening.
I will be king. We can be heroes.